This is episode 30 of The Investors Podcast.
Broadcasting from Bel Air, Maryland, this is The Investors Podcast. They'll read the books and summarize the lessons. They'll test the waters and tell you when it's cold. They'll give you actionable investing strategies. Your host, Preston Pysh and Stig Broderson.
All right, how's everybody doing out there? My name is Preston Pysh, and I'm your host for The Investors Podcast. And as usual, I'm accompanied by my co-host, Stig Broderson, out in Denmark. And today, we've got a really fun one for you, because this one's not what we typically talk about. And we're going to be talking about cryptocurrencies that have emerged on the market in the last 3 to 4 years. And I think for a lot of people, they have no idea what this is. I know I didn't. You just go back 6 months ago. I had no idea what this was. In fact, I heard Bitcoin being mentioned in the news and I just completely ignored it. Had no interest in it at all. I didn't know what they were really talking about. I just, you know, thought it was probably like some type of internet scam that was going on and pretty much ignored it. Then recently, I don't really remember how I came across this, but I started doing some reading. I think it was because I was researching ways to prevent inflation on currencies, and I kind of came across an article on Bitcoin, and it gave a general idea of what it was. And so it kind of piqued my interest, and I started talking to Stig about it, and he was about as skeptical as anybody else on the street. Isn't that right, Stig?
Probably a lot worse, to be quite honest.
So I told Stig, I said, well, let's stop reading these internet articles that we have no idea who wrote these things and what this is about. I said, and let's go find a really good book that is written by somebody that has some credibility, and let's do some research on this and just, you know, read some more and learn about it. So we felt like it'd be kind of a fun topic to talk about on the podcast. So that's why we went out and got this book. And the book that we used for our discussion and to learn about this, it's called The Age of Cryptocurrency: How Bitcoin and Digital Money Are Challenging the Global Economic Order. This was written by two Wall Street Journal journalists, Paul Vigna and Michael Casey. Having read the book, it's a pretty large book. What was it, like 350 pages, Stig? Something like that? 400 pages, maybe?
Yeah, something like that.
It was big. It was good. They were very thorough. That's what I liked. And I thought that their arguments were pretty balanced. I think that they were definitely buying into the fact that cryptocurrencies are going to be the future. But I think that their discussion on Bitcoin and some of the other cryptocurrencies that are out there was pretty balanced, and they gave a really good discussion. So without further delay, Stig and I are just going to kind of jump into this and talk about cryptocurrencies in general. We're going to be pulling some pieces from the book and some other pieces with just general discussion. So our outline for today, we're going to first start off by talking about what is money. So we can have that discussion before we dive into this cryptocurrency stuff any further. But before Stig and I started recording, we quickly went through the outline of what we were going to be doing for today, and we both agreed money is simply an accounting mechanism to keep track of your work performed. And Stig threw out another one by Ray Dalio. Go ahead, Stig, you can tell the audience.
Yes, yeah, so Ray Dalio, he's talking about what is the value of the work that you produce. And I guess it, you know, we can always, you know, say that's controversial, because then we can talk about minimum wage and what, like, billionaires, is that really because that they are you know, producing more value? But basically, if you think of in terms of, you know, if you work more, you get more in pay. I mean, I think that's really good accounting mechanism, as Preston is saying, in terms of, well, what is money really?
Well, and Stig's talking more about the supply and demand of your skill set. So if you're a neurosurgeon and you know how to operate on a person's brain, well, you have a very specialized skill set that only a very few people have in the entire world that have the accreditations to do that kind of work. So you have the an enormous demand, and there's a very small supply that can actually perform that labor. So obviously your value of that work performed is a lot higher than somebody who, you know, is flipping burgers at McDonald's. It's just a fact of life that there's a lot more value being added in that task. So that's what money is. It's an accounting mechanism. So whenever you look at a balance sheet, an income statement, you are keeping track of all the exchanges of your work performed, and whenever you're buying a piece of material, somebody had to perform work in order to create that material. And so all that work is basically stored in these dollars or whatever form of currency. If you're over in Europe, you're using euros. But in general, money is nothing more than an accounting mechanism. So with that idea, that's where we want to start with cryptocurrencies, because it's really hard. I think it's really far-fetched for a lot of people to think that there's just bits of data that are going to be used as money in the future. And I'll tell you, after reading the book and after seeing the technology that exists for this, I really do think that, and I think you already kind of see this, but it's just kind of a mirage for a lot of people, that whenever I send money to Stig in Denmark, it's done through a digital transfer. You know, it's not an actual dollar bills being sent anymore. And I think that a lot of people have, they're actually experiencing a form of cryptocurrency in a way, but they really don't necessarily recognize it for what it is yet. And I think it's only going to get more dramatic as time goes on based on some of the stuff that we were reading in this book. So, Stig, did you have any other comments on what money is or anything like that for the start of the show?
Actually, I come to think of a story here. So we actually see this monetary systems, you know, all over the world. So we are seeing that in, you know, dollars and euros, as Preston was talking about before. But I just thought about this the other day when I was buying Apple dollars. So I was actually buying dollars that Apple said is worth something. And I think I rented a movie or something like that. So basically, you know, this is really just a question of what we agree it is. So that is also a measure of value. I mean, I think I rented a movie for like $5 or something, because that is the value that Apple is providing me. So I just thought there was a funny story.
And I think that in addition to that, I think that if you would get like a gift card at maybe like a restaurant, if it's not redeemable, you're basically putting your money into the currency of whatever that restaurant is or whatever, you know, you purchased the gift card for. But that's a whole nother discussion. We'll just keep moving here. So what's the purpose? Why did Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies emerge in the last 5 years, call it? And there's really two main reasons. And the first one I'm going to talk about, the next one Stig will talk about. But the first one is that governments cannot increase the supply of this cryptocurrency. And so that might sound like a really far-fetched idea for people because it's, you know, bits of data. But how they're actually doing this is they have an open source, and we'll talk about this more later on, but there's open source program algorithm, and it's open source, meaning that there's a group of people that work on it. It's just not one person. And what they've done is they've programmed the algorithm so that it cannot produce more units or coins, if you will, of that system. And so there's 100 coins. Okay. And let's use an example of myself, Stig, Hari, and Colin, the four of us. Okay. And if there's 100 coins and we divide up those 100 coins, each person has 25 of those coins, and the computer algorithm will not let us use any more than 100. You can see how we can keep track of each other's in that little micro economy. If Stig performs some work for me and I give Stig 5 of my coins, my account is now at 20, his is now at 30, and Colin and Hari would then still be at 25. And the way that Bitcoin works, and we're getting into a little bit of the technical, but we'll talk about that now while we use that example. So the way Bitcoin works is I would have a piece of paper. Imagine that I'd have like a digital piece of paper, and each one of us would have a digital piece of paper. So Stig would have one, Hari would have one, and Colin would have one. And so whenever that transaction between Stig and I would take place, where I would give him 5 of my coins, I would update my digital piece of paper so that it says that I have 20 coins and Stig has 30. Stig would also update his digital piece of paper, so it says that he has 30 and I have 20. And so would Hari and Colin, even though they weren't involved in the transaction. So basically, everybody updates that ledger, and that's what it's referred to in cryptocurrency, is the ledger is updated. And so although there was no money, there was nothing physically exchanged as far as the currency goes, the fact that everybody has an updated ledger of where the accounting took place, that's how Bitcoin or any of these cryptocurrencies work. And I find that really fascinating. One other thing that I want to quickly highlight, and I'm getting way off topic, but while I'm on a roll, I want to talk about this. They talk about the different forms of money and how the best type of money to use. And so when you go back into, you know, hundreds of years ago, the type of money that they would always try to use was something that was very durable, something that could hold up over time. Something else that they wanted to use was something that couldn't be replicated or just, you know, produced on a whim, like paper. And so that kind of talks to the reason why cryptocurrency has really emerged is because you can't increase the supply of the money. So that's what they're trying to get around here is all these governments, they're printing money through the nose. They're just printing as much money as they can because then that drops the value of their currency, increases their exports out of the country, which produces their GDP to go up. And so what you have is this race around the world for people to devalue their currency by printing more. And so this cryptocurrency solves that problem by stopping that, by having a fine amount, a limit, a cap, if you will, on the amount of currency that's in the system. The other thing that's nice is that it's completely durable, meaning that you can't break it or, well, you could potentially hack it, which we'll talk about later, but it will last. It's not like it's going to wear out. The other thing that's nice is it's very small. It doesn't, you know, it's not something you even put in your pocket. It'd be something you'd use over your smartphone. So those are the advantages. So it's really kind of interesting to see how this developed and what they're trying to solve here by fixing the inflation, the currency inflation issue. But there's another reason that Bitcoin has emerged, and that's what Stig's going to talk about.
Yeah, and that's really all about cutting out the middleman. So right now we're using banks. And as you're probably all aware of, it's really expensive using banks. So I know this from my own experience. Whenever Preston and I were doing transactions, you know, that is extremely expensive. So not only because I would have to convert that in my own currency, but also because the bank would charge me just for receiving that money. And then when I'm doing my accounting, then my accountant will also charge me for using another currency. So when you have different currencies or actually just sending money to each other, even though it's the same currency, you have some sort of transaction cost. And since banks as a whole really have a monopoly or close to a monopoly on that, things tend to get very expensive. So, you know, whenever I heard about this cryptocurrency and whenever I started reading a book, you know, this was really where I grabbed my attention because I was thinking, well, how can I avoid paying all of those fees? So I think in that sense, I think it's really interesting. So in the developed countries, I think it's really interesting talking about how can we avoid paying those fees because basically Bitcoin that is, I don't know if it's entirely free, but it's the transaction costs almost nothing. That's one side of the coin, really. The other side, that is developing countries. Because one thing I found was really interesting was that they're talking about that 2.5 billion people throughout the world don't have access to a bank account. So, you know, I think that was really interesting because cryptocurrency could really lift up the whole living standard because you need to have a bank account. Really, that's what's one of the fundamentals to improve your living standard. So I thought that was extremely interesting, not just from a personal point of view, but also from a more, humanitarian point of view. And another thing related to this is also that you have a lot of countries that might not be developing or developed, but say something in between. So just to give you an example, something like China or Argentina. And then you have restrictions of foreign currency. So how much foreign currency you can have. So I think that's extremely interesting from the whole system point of view to have a currency that everyone have access to.
So one of the lead program developers for Bitcoin, I was watching a video of him talk about Bitcoin. And he said, the best way I can describe this is it's like having a bank in your pocket. Every single person is their own bank. So if I want to send money to Stig through Bitcoin, there is no transaction fee. It's just, I can just straight send him the money. There's really no delay at all for him to receive those funds. He might want to wait a little bit for the encryption to work itself out so that he can see that it was actually a valid transaction and that there wasn't double spending that occurred. But, it's instantaneous and there's actually no transaction fee whatsoever. So that's what's really, I think, exciting for a lot of people that would potentially be using this. If the currency could actually have a pretty solid and steady rate at which it can be exchanged into other currencies, I think that you would really see this start taking off. But because it's kind of all over the place, you're seeing a lot of hesitation for people to start adopting this. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're just going to go through some of the technicalities of how this stuff works, because I think a lot of people are probably interested in knowing, well, how in the world, who's hosting this software and all that kind of stuff. So like I said earlier, this is open source architecture software, meaning that if you've ever used Wikipedia before, that's the exact same thing. That's open source software that allows people to come in and create updates to different pieces of information, and you revolutionize the way that the encyclopedia works, because everybody around the world is contributing to the information that's housed in that software. So Bitcoin works very similar, and I know that that might have some concerns for people because they think anybody could go in there and edit the source code, but it doesn't necessarily work that way. You have a group of foundational developers that provide updates to the software, but the original software, the source code, was written and is put out there. And so you're probably wondering, well, who in the world wrote the source code? And that's where things get really funny, fun, I don't know what the word is, interesting, scary, all those. What were you going to say, Stig?
I was going to say scary. Yeah. I really enjoyed this this part of the book, though.
So the founder of Bitcoin, specifically, because there's a bunch of these cryptocurrencies out there. We're talking primarily Bitcoin because that's the one that pretty much has the only market cap that's worth watching. But the founder of Bitcoin created this source code in 2009, which I find it kind of ironic that that came right after the crash of 2008, whenever we had this financial meltdown. I thought the timing of that was pretty interesting as well. But this person, he goes by the name Satoshi Nakamoto. Is that right, Stig?
My Japanese is not that good. So sounds right to me.
You can see we're like hardcore Bitcoin people. We don't even know the name of the founder. But Satoshi was the founder of this, or at least that's the name that this person goes by. They say it's a pseudonym, and no one knows who this person is. A lot of people think that his Satoshi name is fictitious. I read some stuff where based on the timestamps of when this person was working and posting in the forums whenever they are developing this, they think that a lot of the time lines up with an East Coast U.S. time frame, and that the person wasn't actually working this in Japan. So, but there are so many different accounts. I mean, if you want to read some funny stuff on the internet, try to type in his name and just see what you get. And you're going to find a lot of people that have theories and hypothesis of how Bitcoin was created, who the original founder is. There's people out there that think that it was actually groups or organizations. Some people think that it could be government organizations that created this. But in general, it is a really fun discussion and research topic if you guys want to start digging into that. So why the person wanted to be anonymous, I have no idea. But for some reason, this person who created Bitcoin did not want people to know who they were. And I will say that whenever he did this, he holds a very large number of the Bitcoins, correct? I don't know how many, but I think it's a very large chunk of the Bitcoins. This founder still has them. And so I think whenever the price was up at like $1,000 a Bitcoin, this person was a billionaire. Whoever they are, they became a billionaire whenever the price was that high. I don't know if they're still based on the current market price, because a Bitcoin right now is like $250. So it's open source architecture. That's what we were talking about. And so people can add to this and adjust it. But the developers add changes very, very cautiously, where they go through testing, and you could read all about it. But it is a very cautious implementation of code. And so you might be asking, well, that's really scary. And I think that it is a little scary to think that just random people that you don't even know could be adjusting this code, and then lead developers who you also don't know are adding the code into the open source architecture. But one of the things that I think that I need to throw out there that I think kind of counterbalances that concern is that the people, the lead developers on this, probably own a lot of Bitcoins. Well, I know they do. They own a lot of Bitcoins. And the last thing that they want to see is for this thing to fail, because they've got millions of dollars tied up in this because they own so many Bitcoins. So I think that that's a good counter argument. I don't know if that's something that you want to throw 100% of your trust in, but That's probably what would maybe counterbalance that concern. So like we said earlier, there was 21 million Bitcoins that are going to be the final number of Bitcoins that are released into the public. Right now, there is not 21 million Bitcoins in existence. There's far less than that. I want to say there's 14 million Bitcoins in existence, somewhere around there. And what happens is the Bitcoins are in, they're going through an inflationary period, which we said couldn't happen, but it is happening, and I'll explain why. So whenever Bitcoin first started, there was only a finite number of coins. And what happens is this computer algorithm is going through and releasing more Bitcoins into the system, and it'll max out at 21 million in the year, like 21 something, in a 100-year period. But a majority of the Bitcoins are going to be released into the public over the next couple years. I think from 2016 on, your inflation rate on Bitcoins goes down below 5%. It's a very small number of Bitcoins. And I think that the reason that they had that is because they expected the number of users to continue to increase with the inflation of the coins. But within a decade from now, the inflation rate is going to be very low, like a 2% inflation rate that you'd see in a regular currency. And then as time goes on and you get further into the decades, it's pretty much no more Bitcoins being released. And they actually say it'll be deflationary because some of the accounts that are going to be used, people will forget the passwords, and then those coins will be locked in that account forever. So kind of a really... it's really just, all this stuff is fascinating to me. I don't know. I found it extremely interesting. Stig, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I was really blown away by this book. At least from more ideological point of view. I think sooner we were talking about, or later we were talking about whether or not we want to invest in Bitcoins. But you know, I think this man, he must be one of the most, or organization Nakamoto, he must be one of the most brilliant guys ever walk this planet. Because you know, thinking about putting up a system to revolutionize the whole monetary system and just inventing that, and that's amazing. I mean, how can you come up with that?
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
The dream of owning a vacation home can be daunting. From finding the best guests, to the maintenance, to organizing the cleaners after every guest stay. With Vacasa, they make that dream into a reality. As a full-service vacation home management company with vacation homes in key destinations across the U.S., they know how to make owning a vacation home easy and profitable. On top of proactive property maintenance visits by professional local teams, a data-driven booking platform, and around-the-clock support, homeowners earn on average 20% or more revenue from their vacation homes. Vacasa makes vacation home ownership easy. If you're looking to make more from your vacation home by doing less, partner with Vacasa at Vacasa.com. That's Vacasa.com to get started on your dream of owning a vacation home. Have you ever wondered if there's an AI tool like ChatGPT specifically built for the stock market? A tool that not only aids you in your research and analysis process, but also allows for dynamic discussions? Today, I want to share such a tool with you called Meka. Meka is the AI-powered stock research assistant now enhanced with real-time stock data. Meka does a lot of the heavy lifting of sifting through financial statements and company data and delivers it to you nearly instantaneously, and the best part is that it's 100% free. Try it out today and ask Meka questions like, what is the financial health of Microsoft? How much cash does Copart hold on its balance sheet? What is the return on invested capital of Adobe, or millions of other prompts? Check it out today for free at Meyka.com. That's Meyka.com. Today's episode is sponsored by Range Rover Sport. Range Rover Sport leads by example with their dynamic design that rises to the occasion. It's got powerful on-road performance and commanding all-terrain capabilities, coupled with signature Range Rover refinement. The third generation Range Rover Sport is the most desirable, advanced, and dynamically capable one yet, redefining sporting luxury. It's got advanced cabin technologies such as active noise cancellation and cabin air purification, offering next level comfort and refinement. The purposeful cockpit light driving position sets the tone for a focused interior that promotes exhilarating driver engagement. Award-winning Pivi Pro infotainment is at the heart of the experience and provides intuitive control of the vehicle systems. You can enjoy a dynamic drive and total comfort with optional 22-way adjustable, heated, and ventilated electric memory front seats with massage function. Design your Range Rover Sport at LandRoverUSA.com. That's LandRoverUSA.com.
All right, back to the show.
I'll be honest with you. I went and I read some of his original writings, this Satoshi Nakamoto's original writings that are out there on the internet. And it is mind blowing. I totally agree with you. I think this guy might be one of the smartest people that I've ever come across some of his writings before. For him to understand, because he has to understand a lot of different things here. First of all, you got to understand contracts, because these are really smart contracts that are taking place. He has to understand encryption to just like a ridiculous level, which is extremely difficult stuff if you've never studied encryption before. And then you have to have this unbelievable understanding of economics, macroeconomics, microeconomics, and how exchanges take place. And this person would have had all this knowledge. I just find it, you know, I find it a little hard to believe that it's just one person, but maybe there is just this total savant out there that just created this. It's really quite fascinating. So let's go a little bit more into the technical real fast so that you can really have an appreciation for what I'm talking about. So you know how I was saying that there's going to be more Bitcoins added to the system over this short period of time to get them all out into the economy. And so how those are being released is an idea called mining. So if you remember how I was telling you that I would have like a virtual piece of paper and I would be keeping track of every one of the people's accounts in our small group. Well, that's what mining is. So if you have a computer and you want to mine, meaning you want to keep track of the ledger of all these different accounts, you can do that. And what you're doing whenever you're keeping that ledger, you're constantly trying to solve like a puzzle. And it's an encryption puzzle. And if you solve the encryption puzzle correctly, you're the one that basically validated all the transactions on this blockchain that's ongoing. And this is very technical. We are breezing over this because we have, at least I do, I don't know about Stig, but I have troubles understanding it myself to a very detailed level. But in short, these miners are validating the transactions by solving these puzzles, these encryption puzzles. And whenever they do that, they receive Bitcoin for doing that and basically housing the ledger on their computer. So that's how the new Bitcoins are being added into the system, is that they're basically rewards to people that are using or housing this ledger and saving this ledger and confirming all the transactions and keeping it. And so what the founder, this Satoshi, had in mind whenever he was developing Bitcoin was, I need to get a bunch of people to house this ledger on their computers. And once I get enough people that can do that, then the way that payment basically will take place whenever all the Bitcoins max out is there'll be a transaction fee, but it'll be very minor transaction fee that's paid to the people that are confirming the transactions. So that's a whole nother story in itself, and it gets very detailed whenever you start getting into some of the technical. So that's all the more that I was going to talk for the technical, unless you had anything else that you wanted to add, Stig.
No, I think it's, I don't get all this, Preston. You know, I'm just listening, and I really appreciate that you explain to me how this is happening. I got to be completely honest with you. I thought there was really a hard part of the book, really understanding the technical part. So, you know, another good reason why this Nakamoto guy, he couldn't be alone doing this thing. How he can program this whole thing and do everything, I have no clue how one person can do that.
That's the other part is like, yeah, so he has like this amazing understanding of economics, but then now he has to go program the initial code, the foundational code, this open source architecture code that does all this. I find that really hard to believe that one person did this. And I think that's what really piques a lot of the interest within the community of people that are really tracking this closely is like, so who did this? What group did this potentially? It is fascinating. But anyway, let's go ahead and move on to the next thing, because I think I confused everybody enough with the technical piece. What we'll do in the show notes to kind of help people out, because whenever I was reading the book, I was really trying to understand it. And there was parts where I was really having difficulty understanding it as well. But I went and supplemented that with some videos that I found on YouTube on how the technical piece of it works. We will have that in the show notes. And I'll tell you, folks, come watch this on our show notes so that you can see this, because it is really quite fascinating. I think you'll get a kick out of it at the minimum. Okay, so we're going to briefly talk about how Bitcoin has performed to date. So whenever Bitcoin first came out, there was, you know, this supposedly Satoshi basically mining all the Bitcoins onto his computer. Then he told some other people in this encryption forum, that's where this originated, about this. And so then other people started doing it just for fun, and they were getting thousands of Bitcoins saved on their computer, which were completely worthless at the time. And then as more and more people adopted it, there was the very first purchase that took place, where a person from England paid for a pizza, a Papa John's pizza, for somebody in Florida. And I think they exchanged 10,000 Bitcoins for that pizza. So that means that the transaction for that pizza was a $10 million transaction if that person would have held on to those and then sold out at whenever Bitcoin hit $1,000 a coin. So I find that hilarious. And I think that that's going to be pretty interesting. You know, if Bitcoin, you know, looking 10 years down the road, 20 years down the road, if it does appreciate in value, which is a huge if, I think people will look back at that first transaction of 10,000 Bitcoins for a pizza and maybe just be just blown away. But that's how Bitcoin's first got its first transaction with really monetary value, or something of real value to it, was a Papa John's pizza. Then what you had was, have you ever seen these young kids that play Magic the Gathering, where they've got these cards, these magic cards, and they're like trading them? I don't really understand the game, but I've seen kids play it before. There was a website called Mt. Gox. And Mt. Gox was, it's somehow the acronym has to do with Magic the Gathering. That's what they actually sold at Mt. Gox, was Magic the Gathering. And so a lot of this crowd of people, these magic people, were some of the early adopters of Bitcoin. And so Mt. Gox, which was this internet trading site where you could buy these magic cards, you had people start trading Bitcoins there and trading them for real money. And that's where there started to be, it was basically the first open market for Bitcoins. Through the years, this is the Mt. Gox, I guess the founder of Mt. Gox, the person who was running this exchange, really had no idea what they were doing whenever they started getting this influx of all these Bitcoin people trying to trade their Bitcoins for currency. Had a huge fallout because the person mismanaged some of the exchanges. Millions of dollars were lost. I think the person might have gone to jail who was running it. I don't really know. But there was a lot of people, whenever they hear Bitcoin and they hear like the negative vibe that's associated with it, it almost all goes back to this Mt. Gox thing, because whenever the Mt. Gox, kind of that company fell apart, you saw the price of Bitcoin just go through the floor, because I don't think there was really an exchange for people to trade their coins anymore. And so then that had an impact on the price, and people were just trying to get rid of them, and it was a whole fallout. So where you have a big misnomer is a lot of people thought that there was a hack or there was something wrong with Bitcoin and the software itself, but there was not. It was actually this third party company that was basically acting as like a stock exchange of these Bitcoins that fell apart and had issues. And that was the reason that you had the major price go down. I think it was it before or after Mt. Gox? I don't remember, but the price of Bitcoin basically started, just had this massive acceleration. And I want to say, when was that? Back in 2013, Stig?
Yeah, just early 2013, yeah.
Okay, so early 2013, you saw the price of Bitcoin go from like 100, 200 bucks, and it just went through the roof. It went up to over 1,000. I think it got up to like $1,100 or $1,200 a Bitcoin. And then you just saw it go down ever since. From 2013 till now, you've seen it go down and go down and go down. And now it's at around $250 a coin. And who knows where it's going to go from here? That's the big if. So that's kind of been the performance of Bitcoin to date. Stig, did you have any other comments for that piece of it?
No, I think I'm all good. I think you explained that very well, Chris.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Okay, so let's go to the next thing. And the next topic that we're going to be talking about is, what's the future going to look like for Bitcoin? And I think that this one here is where we're just going to, you know, take out our tinfoil hats and put them on and act like we actually know what's going to happen here, because this is like the biggest if ever. And Stig's going to go ahead and take this point. He's going to talk about this.
Okay, so yeah, first of all, you know, I think it's kind of funny that, you know, two, let's call us experts, are going to predict what's going to happen with a cryptocurrency that we have no clue about. What was even, you know, a month ago when we haven't read this book, we had no clue what it was. And now we're going to predict the future.
That's right.
I love that.
And well, what I think is going to be probably the best way for our audience to know what to do is just do the opposite of whatever we say, and you'll probably be right.
I completely agree. Yeah, so the first thing I want to talk about, that's really trust. I think that the future of cryptocurrency and Bitcoin in particular, that really boils down to trust. And so if we take the example from before about, you know, Apple dollars, you know, I don't know if I trust Apple, you know, in particular, but I'm pretty sure that the $50 that I put up for this, you know, gift card, whatever it was, you know, I will get my money worth of that. And even if I don't, you know, I would be terribly sorry, but I think I can swing $50, right? So, you know, I'm willing to buy into different currencies, if you can say that Apple dollars is a currency, because it does not really matter if this system would fail or not. I think a lot of people, including myself, really perhaps don't trust Bitcoins, even though that they really dig more into what Bitcoin really is, that they might not really trust Bitcoin, not as the leading currency. And I think that before Bitcoin will be a leading currency like the euro or a dollar, I think you will keep seeing this high volatility that you're experiencing. So for instance, what Preston was saying before, you would see it, you know, increase tenfold only to drop to a quarter of that value today. So having a system, having a monetary system, and the whole reason for the monetary system is really to ensure stability. At least that's a big reason for that. Having a system that is not completely stable, I think that would be really, really hard. And I think it would be really hard for people to trust that system. So it's kind of like, I think, you know, from a humanitarian point of view, I think it would be fantastic if we had Bitcoin. But before we trust it, we won't have a stable currency, and we won't have a stable currency before we trust it. So I think it's going to be really, really hard to have Bitcoin really to be a leading currency. I don't know if I'm just too skeptic. What do you say, Preston?
Yeah, I think that whenever you look at something that has an enormous strength, there's always an enormous weakness that's actually attached to that, tethered to that. And I think with Bitcoin, you know, a lot of people out there really like the idea that the government has no interaction or no control over the fact that these transactions are taking place. It's completely decentralized. So you don't have to worry about Ben Bernanke or somebody like that coming in and just adding a ton of new Bitcoins if the market would go down or whatever. That's the advantage. That's the huge advantage that everybody likes. Now, the disadvantage that's associated, that's basically tethered to that, is the idea that you don't have some Federal Reserve that can come in here and rescue the economy if it would collapse, if everyone would have started adopting Bitcoins. And so I think that that's kind of the bittersweet piece of this, is that people like the fact that it's decentralized, but I think other people have total concern over the fact that it's decentralized and you'd have no control, you'd have no government backing on the currency itself. So if some hacker would come in and would actually have the ability to hack this system and take it down, everyone would lose all their money. It's just that simple. And so that's a huge concern. I mean, I don't think you could get a bigger concern that the whole thing could just collapse overnight. And I think that that trust barrier is going to be the biggest difficulty for people to overcome when dealing with this. And I think another concern too is, you know, if I had to explain this to my mother, okay, or my grandparents, would they would look at me like I'm crazy. They'd be like, what in the world are you talking about? That it's saved on a ledger and people are mining coins, and like they would look at me like I'm an alien. And so how are you going to get a large people to have trust in something that they cannot understand? I mean, you and I are having trouble understanding this, and we just read a whole 400-page book on it. So How is the person who's never read anything on this going to trust this or believe it? And I think that's one of the biggest hurdles that they've got to overcome, is that piece of it.
Yeah, and the real thing, you have a good point about saying what is really the strength is also the weakness, because you have a really strong niche community around Bitcoin. But I think having this decentralized currency, that would be really hard to make a leading currency, because as you said, there's no one to back it. We don't have anyone who profits from it, so we don't have a strong intermediary sector like the banking sector. And we don't have anyone to back it like a government or a Federal Reserve. So I think that if you want to go in that direction, you know, make it more build some kind of profit margin into Bitcoin, I think, you know, a lot of people would leave it because that's really why they like it. But I think that if you don't have that, and as Preston said before, you only have five people really running the show, which is like the central administration, you know, I don't think they can respond fast enough and efficient enough if there's ever any problems. So it's kind of like the whole trust and stability, you know, whatever comes first. But I really don't think any of the two things will come. I think that's really the challenge for Bitcoin.
So I will say this. I think that that's the problem that they have, is for people to adopt it and to start using it because they're not going to understand it. But I do think this. I think that they've got a very good source code, and I think that it's going to be very hard for somebody to hack it. Do I think somebody could hack it? I don't necessarily know. I think it's pretty solid, to be honest with you. I would say it. I think it has a really strong chance of holding up. So I guess I'm optimistic on its ability to actually sustain itself into the future. Just as long as computer power, you know, the processing power doesn't, you know, have some extreme quantum leap that we're not expecting. I think that's the only thing that could really throw it off, because then the encryption could be cracked. But right now the encryption is so hardcore. You're not going to crack it. So that's where I guess I see it. I guess I have trust in its ability to sustain itself into the near future, in the next 10 years. But I think a lot of other people might not. So I see cryptocurrencies and the current Federal Reserve type system coexisting. Okay, I don't see Bitcoin basically making the dollar obsolete. I just don't see that happening. But I do see them working harmoniously with each other, where I really think Bitcoin's going to be used in 10 or 20 years from now. I could see it being used, cryptocurrencies in general, being used exactly like gold, where it's a store of value that people go to whenever they're fearful, or whenever the market, whenever they're thinking that inflation is going to occur or whatever. I think that it could be a source of protection for people to put their money into it.
Yeah, and another thing to consider is also that Preston and I'd be really, I don't want to speak on behalf of you, but at least I'm thinking in terms of, you know, the Western world. I'm thinking in terms of being a small business owner, being able to explain to my mom why she should buy Bitcoins, which I have no intention of doing. But, you know, so this is, you know, our point of view. I think that when you have a developing world where there are so many people who don't have access to a bank account, you know, even though you see a lot of volatility, you know, that might still be a lot safer and a lot better than just carrying around cash. So, I mean, to me, it's not like I carry a lot of cash, but, you know, I have a bank account. I have a system that I trust. I think that if you live in some rural area of the world and you don't have all that security, you know, the danger of having a hacker to hack your account, that's nothing compared to walking around with your net worth in your pocket. So I think in some developing countries, I think this might be the solution in the time to come.
And I totally agree with you. 1,000%. In fact, I think that Bitcoin is really going to get its start in emerging markets. I think that whenever you go to a country that really has serious currency issues, I think Bitcoin is going to be the solution. And it's just so easy. And we'll talk about this later to use. And I think that here's another thing. I think that if a country would adopt Bitcoin is basically their currency. Say you have a really poor country and their currency is just super corrupt. I could totally see Bitcoin emerge as the solution for the people within that country to start using it. And I think that you might see that slow adoption within third world countries around the world. And I think that's where this is going to get its start. Okay, so if this is truly going to catch on, there's going to have to be people with a lot of money that throw some weight behind this. And I think that's really kind of one of the critical variables, is you've got to get the right mix of people. And I mean, imagine if a billionaire goes and drops $100 million into Bitcoin, that's going to have a huge impact just psychologically, because what's this guy know? Why is he doing this? And I think that you're going to have people that piggyback on that, not to mention you'll have a larger market cap on the currency itself. And so that's the one piece that Stig and I were kind of researching on our own, was, okay, who, if this is really going to work, who out there is already doing it and why are they doing it? So there's a couple of key people that we looked at. One of the biggest investors that we found out there were the Winklevoss twins. If you're not familiar with the Winklevoss twins, they were supposedly co-founders with Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook. They went through this big legal dispute because they went to Harvard together. These gentlemen are actually Olympic rowers, which I found also very interesting. But they went through this huge legal dispute, and they have put a ton of their money into Bitcoin. I know that they've invested around $10 million of their own money just by owning the cryptocurrency of Bitcoin itself. And then they're standing up their own stock exchange around Bitcoin. And they're also standing up another company relating to Bitcoin. So these guys are heavily invested in Bitcoin. The other person I want to talk about, who we always talk about, is Warren Buffett. What's his opinion on this? And so there was a really funny interview that I've got pulled up here, and I'm going to read it to you. He was on Fox News, and Liz Claman was the one interviewing him. And I'm going to read the exchange so you can kind of hear this. And this is really cool because it's Warren Buffett, it's Charlie Munger, and it's Bill Gates on their opinion of Bitcoin. So this was the question that was posed to these three gentlemen. We need to talk about Bitcoin in a minute. I can't wait to hear what Charlie Munger has to say about this. Let's bring in Charlie Munger, the vice chairman of Berkshire Hathaway. Bill's going to move over so you can come sit down. Good morning, Charlie. And so Charlie says, good morning. I don't know if you've ever seen any of his videos, but he is absolutely hilarious when he talks. I just laugh whenever I listen to him because he's just so his sense of humor is so dry. And I guess I really like dry sense of humor. So but anyway, so Liz Claman says, I just had to get your thoughts on Bitcoin, this digital currency that's out there that people say, oh, it might be the next big thing. What do you think, Charlie Munger? I think it's rat poison. Warren Buffett interrupts. He goes, put him down as undecided. And Liz Claman says, do you understand what they're trying to do with it? Charlie says, no, but I regard it as deeply flaky. And Liz Claman says, deeply flaky. Okay, Bitcoin. Bill Gates, what do you think? Bill Gates says, I think it's the technical tour de force. But that's an area where governments are going to maintain a dominant role. That's Bill Gates's way of saying that he thinks that it's revolutionary, but he thinks that he's a little concerned about what the government's role is going to be as they regulate it. And so then Liz says, Warren, what do you think? And so Warren says, I think either Charlie or Bill is right. And that was their exchange. So it was kind of a short, funny exchange. I thought that would be pretty fun to read. But of course, Warren's always in the middle. You know, he's just, oh boy, the beacon of balance.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in over 20 strategic locations. They have extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com. As someone who's constantly on the road and traveling, Briggs & Riley has been a game changer that ensures my travel experience is phenomenal. I'm a satisfied customer of Briggs & Riley myself, and I can certainly tell you that their luggage performs. It's extremely durable, it has amazing features that make packing and getting around easier, and they have the best lifetime guarantee in the industry. If your bag is ever broken or damaged, they'll repair it free of charge, no questions asked, even if your airline damages the bag. They also just released their Simpatico collection of hard-sided luggage. It has this new one-touch feature which allows you to expand your luggage, pack it, then compress it to its original size so a carry-on can still fit in the overhead compartment, plus many other cool features. If you want luggage that was awarded the best carry-on by Forbes, then now's the time to get it. Get your new and improved luggage at Briggs-Riley.com. That's Briggs-Riley.com.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. you can earn 4x points on your top two eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4x points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
All right, back to the show.
Okay, so Warren Buffett, you heard Warren Buffett, Charlie Munger. Bill Gates thinks that it has a lot of potential. He's very concerned, and I've watched some other videos of Bill Gates talking about Bitcoin, and his big concern is really the government's role in it. So the people that I really am focusing on, that I'm trying to really understand their opinions, are these founders of PayPal, because I think those guys understand this space better than anybody out there. Because people might not realize this, but that's one of the things that PayPal was trying to do back in 2000. They were trying to create their own digital currency to basically make it a global currency around the world. They were not successful in doing that. And so the people that I really want to focus a lot on are people like Reid Hoffman, because he was a PayPal, one of the founders of PayPal. You got Peter Thiel, who's a billionaire now, that we also pay very close attention to. We did one of his books in one of our earlier episodes. And the other person is Elon Musk, who went on to do Tesla and SpaceX. He was also a PayPal. And these guys are called the PayPal Mafia, if you've never heard that before. So those are the gentlemen that I'm paying very close attention to when it comes to Bitcoin. And so Reid Hoffman, the founder of LinkedIn, he, I guess, in the last couple months, made a purchase. It's probably pennies for him, the amount of money that he put into it. But I think it's around like the 40 million mark. Maybe it's hard for me to remember what all the stuff that I was reading. But I think he's dropped tens of millions into an investment of a company that would be basically like a wallet application for Bitcoin. And the stuff that I read on Elon Musk, I don't think that he has really invested much in it at all. And then the other person is Peter Thiel. And so we've got an audio clip that we're going to play for you from Peter Thiel, who's this billionaire who now owns Palantir. He is the original founder of PayPal. And so he understands this space really well. And we're going to play an audio clip from him. Before we play that, I also want to highlight that Richard Branson owns some Bitcoins. How many? I mean, he might own one Bitcoin for all we know, but I'd imagine he owns a few since he's so wealthy. And then this gentleman named Patrick Byrne, who is the CEO and owner of Overstock.com. He is a huge proponent of Bitcoin. So he's another person if you want to do some research and look up what he's done. There's one other thing that I wanted to throw out before we play the audio clip. And that was in January 2015, Silicon Valley put a bunch of money, $75 million into this company called Coinbase, which is another wallet application for Bitcoin. So if you wanted to buy Bitcoin and you wanted to store it in a digital wallet, Coinbase is probably the company that you'd go to right now that's located in the US at least. So what we're going to do is we're going to go and we're going to play this audio clip of Peter Thiel. This came from probably about 2 months ago. I think he did this in January of 2015, that these were his opinions on Bitcoin. So we're going to play that for you now.
I mean, as you look back at PayPal, which is where you first sort of really came, you know, got a successful business out there that made a lot of money. I mean, we've now had this revived interest in Bitcoin and, you know, digital currencies and so forth, you know, which I think all run up against the problem of, you know, will the state allow a private money system to exist? Do you think that PayPal could have evolved differently along those lines, or do you think that fundamentally, you know, that could have been the equivalent of Uber for finance, and is Bitcoin going to do it this time around?
Let's see. So I always think PayPal had these goals of creating a new currency. We failed at that. We just created a new payment system. I think Bitcoin has succeeded on the level of a new currency. The payment system is somewhat lacking, so it's actually very hard to use, and that's probably the big challenge that exists on the Bitcoin side. I would say with respect to finance, we're generally in a more heavily regulated world than we were in 1999-2000 when PayPal got started. And so it might actually be very difficult to start PayPal today. I'm not even sure you could build PayPal today because the regulations are tougher. And so there was sort of a lot of this was in a somewhat gray zone in 1999-2000. Today, it might be much harder to get started, much bigger barriers to entry. At the same time, you know, know, there's still a lot of people trying to do things in financial technology in one way or another. Challenges that it's a sector where you're having increasingly heavy regulatory headwinds, and that's a big worry.
I mean, if you were to sort out the payment system around Bitcoin, I mean, do you think it could catch on in a way that would be seriously disruptive to existing fiat currencies?
Hard to say. You know, the fiat currencies. You know, if you look at a dollar bill, it says, you know, this is legal tender for all debts, public and private, and the stress you have to always put is on the word public. And so, as long as you have to have dollars to pay your taxes, and if you don't have dollars to pay your taxes, people with guns will come after you, and lock you up or do something bad to you. You know, you can't use Bitcoin to pay taxes. You'll have to still convert it into dollars. And so on that level, it doesn't really threaten the supremacy of the dollar as a reserve currency, which is probably ultimately backed up by U.S. military power.
And what if a government somewhere, you know, maybe the Swiss or someone, was to say, let's embrace an algorithmic digital currency and put the weight of the state behind it? Do you think that's what Bitcoin needs to take it to really catch on and be an effective currency?
Well, it becomes a threat. Let me put it this way. It becomes a threat to fiat money at a point where Bitcoin is encrypted in such a robust way that the tax authorities can't break the encryption, can't tell how much money you have, what transactions you're doing, where it all becomes untraceable. And there was sort of a 90s cypher anarchist vision of the future where encryption technology would make it very hard for the tax authorities to break in. And it was like this defensive technology where the state could not would get diminishing returns on violence and extracting revenues or tax revenues from its subjects. Now, this is not the way the computer revolution has really gone in the last 17 years. So in the 90s, we were thought of the IT revolution as trending towards a decentralized world that empowered individuals. Today, it's again perceived as trending towards centralized databases, centralized servers, a more transparent world, a world in which privacy is always perceived to be somewhat threatened. And that's one where you know, and again, Bitcoin only works, only threatens if you can't trace any of the things you're doing with it.
Okay, so you can see from Peter's comment there that he's not too concerned about the government piece of it with respect to Bitcoin being a threat to the dollar, which I totally agree with him. And I think that he brings up a really good point that it could always just be converted into dollars in order to pay your taxes. And that's why I think the U.S. government, at least, would never have some issues. When you look at the news, there's a lot of countries out there that do have issues with Bitcoin. You look at China. I know over in the UK, they were pretty restrictive on some things. I think Russia is pretty restrictive on it. And so it really depends on the government as you go around the world. But there's some governments that are more accepting of it than others. But I think in general terms, when you hear Peter talk about it, I think that, and there were some other spots in that interview that we didn't play where he talks about, I think the gentleman says, what do you think the probability of success is for Bitcoin, at least? And I think he says somewhere around like 20% or something like that, 20 or 30%. So he, I think at this point in time, still sees it as a potential, but not a real high probability event that Bitcoin's going to really kind of take things by storm. That's his opinion. And I think that he holds probably more weight on that opinion than anybody else in the world just because of his background with PayPal, or at least that's how I'm treating it. So this comes to our final point in the show. Should you invest in Bitcoin? And I think that's really the big question here. So Stig, let's get your opinion.
No. Wow, that was way too short. You know, I think that my problem with Bitcoins is that I don't know how to estimate the intrinsic value. It's sort of like I don't want to invest in dollars either because, you know, to me, the dollar doesn't really have intrinsic value. Well, it does in the sense that I know that I could get a given amount of groceries for $1, for instance. But it really doesn't make any sense for me to buy as it doesn't produce anything. So it's really hard for me to say that today the the price is $250, but the intrinsic value is $600. I mean, I don't know how to make that estimation. And I think that is really what's puzzled me. Perhaps if I knew more about the currency, you know, it might be easier for me to do that. And it might be a good investment for some. It certainly has. But I think that is my main problem. That is, I don't know how to estimate the intrinsic value.
So for me, I've got a little bit of a different opinion. For me, I guess every investment that I do, I look at the upside versus the downside. So the downside on Bitcoin is that it loses all of its value. Somebody hacks it or the government basically shuts it down and you lose pretty much everything in it. So the downside is huge. The upside, whenever I look at it, I think the upside is also huge. When you look at it as a currency, a global currency, let's just say you have 1% adoption across the world on Bitcoin. If you added up all the different currencies around the world and Bitcoin would take up a 1% spot in that, that would put the value of one Bitcoin well over $1,000. Probably, I would say at like, let's call it like 10,000 bucks is what I would think that a 1% mark would probably be. If it would take even more than 1%, then you're talking an even higher value. So for me, I see that there's a very high upper limit on the value of Bitcoin if you even have a small amount of adoption around the world. I guess for me, if I take a small position, a very small position in this, I don't necessarily see that as a bad thing. If you have the ability to just straight up lose it, it's almost like casino odds, I think, are probably where you're at. Like, if you're going to play a roulette, your chances of winning are like 47%. So I kind of see Bitcoin in a very similar manner, but I think that the upside is very, very big. It's not like you're getting double your money. You could potentially get 1,000 times your initial investment. And that's why it kind of piques my interest. Did I buy Bitcoin? Yes, I bought a few Bitcoins. Do I recommend other people buying Bitcoins? Not really. I think that if you have the ability to just say, hey, I fully expect that I could lose all this and it's not going to really make that much of a dent in my portfolio, or I'm going to enjoy just kind of doing this, then I think you should do it. But I think if you're relying on that money and you're really looking at that money for retirement purposes or whatever, this is probably not a sound investment for you.
Yeah. So I just want to say two quick things. The first thing that is that you can actually buy an ETF that is tracking the price of Bitcoin. So if you are not up for whole opening an account and doing, understanding the system, it's really easy just to buy an ETF. At least if you're a stock investor, you know how that system works. The other thing that is, do what you necessarily need to invest in Bitcoins to invest in Bitcoins? And I would say no. You also have a chance to invest in the sector. So there is a lot of, you can think of this like, oil. Are you buying an oil company or are you just buying a barrel of oil? I mean, I think that's probably very similar. So I would say that, especially after listening to the thing about Silicon Valley and all the money that is putting money into the industry, I don't know the sector that well, but I think there might be, a way to profit from Bitcoins without buying Bitcoins, because I think that the whole technology is something that is worth considering. Whether or not the intrinsic value is overvalued, undervalued, I think that's harder to understand.
So I want to give you an example of something that a person told me whenever we were having a discussion on this. And he was talking about back in 1849, there was an American gold rush out in California. And all these people were going out in the droves to California to try to find gold and to make it rich. And he said that the average person that went out there actually went bust and really never found any gold at all. But the people who made a ton of money were the people who were selling the pans and the shovels and all the gear that complemented the people to try to find the gold. And so Stig's point is a very good one. I think if you are interested in potentially investing in this area, I think a very safe play would maybe be doing something that would be an index for cryptocurrencies. Because one of my concerns is really, this is open source software. So what's there to stop anybody from coming along and using the open source software to start their own coin and call it Coin Z or whatever the coin might be called that would then compete with Bitcoin? And you actually have that happening right now. I think that there's hundreds of cryptocurrencies out there. None of them are getting any kind of traction because I think they're having a hard time overcoming the branding of Bitcoin. Everyone knows Bitcoin because they've heard it in the news. So that's a hard obstacle to overcome at the present moment. But that doesn't mean that some other form of a cryptocurrency could come along in 3 years from now and just all the money that's in Bitcoin gets basically pushed out of that and into this other cryptocurrency. Then that one emerges and then you're out all your money. So I think that Stig has a very good point that if you are interested in investing this and you're a little hesitant to do the Bitcoin leap, which I think is a very good and sound decision if it's not money that you just feel like you can just throw away. I think that that's the best way you need to look
like
at
you, Preston.
Like, no, that's definitely not me. I promise you. But I, you know, the reason I did it is because I was more interested in understanding the technology. I wanted to see what it was like to buy something with Bitcoin, to have my own wallet, to just kind of conduct transactions. That's more of the reason why I did it than the investment side of it. Because I wanted to understand how easy it was, how there was no transaction cost. I wanted to just basically play with the toy, I guess is the best way to describe it. That's what I was doing. But I am close. I am tracking this very closely because I think that there is huge upside potential. It's just a matter of when that's going to hit and when you're going to have critical mass where you have a lot of people adopting it and it takes off. So I think it's definitely worth watching, but something that you need to stand on the sidelines for. And I will say this, since I have played around with the Coinbase account and used it a little, it is very easy to use. I was on my phone. I went up to a QRC, like a scanner code. I just scanned it with my smartphone. I said how much I was going to send. I hit the send button and boom, it was gone. It was that simple. And there was no transaction fee whatsoever. It was pretty amazing, to be quite honest with you. So just fascinating technology. But a lot more to be shaken out on this type of technology in the coming years. And I think that it's something that people need to maybe look at a little bit closer and not just write off as being something that drug dealers and all these other people, which there's that whole side of the story that we didn't even talk about today. It's called Silk Road. That's a whole nother piece of this that has a real negative connotation to it. And I think that a reason a lot of people are just very weary of it all is because of stories like that. Yes, go ahead, Sig.
Yeah, and before people are thinking too much about what does drug dealers have to do with cryptocurrency, the thing is really that the strength about cryptocurrency or these bitcoins is that you're anonymous. So that has a lot of good things to it. You don't need to be validated. You don't need to be approved by a bank. But it also attracts some sketchy people, for instance, like drug dealers, because you can't be anonymous. So I think it's really hard to admit that side if you want to have a Bitcoin system that has all the advantages. I think that's pretty much just the price you have to pay if that is what you want to set up.
Yeah, I would totally agree. All right, so we're at the point in the show where we're going to play a question from our audience. And so this question comes from Stas Plunkin, and here's his question.
Hello, Preston and Stig. My name is Stas. I'm from Frankfurt, Germany. Recently, I read a book, Too Big to Fail, by Andrew Sorkin. And while reading, I realized that large market players like Goldman Sachs, large commercial banks, investment banks, as well as huge investors like Warren Buffett, they actually receive new and partly insider information straight away and actually do act on it. So my question for Gillen and you guys as well, do you really believe that we, average investors, have a chance to be successful with investing in stocks and bonds while we do not have the competitive advantage the sharks and professional players do? Thank you very much.
Yeah, so Stas, I really like this question. And I'm going to start off my answer with a quote, and it's actually a quote from Warren Buffett. And what he's saying is that with enough insider information and $1 million, you can go broke in a year. So I found that quote quite funny. Now, do Warren Buffett have some kind of insider information? Sure. And what I think Warren Buffett really means with this quote is that when he's talking about insider information, I think he's talking about people thinking that they know something that other people don't. And I actually think that's a really dangerous approach to have. If you're thinking that you are sitting with the knowledge about what a company will do, I think that you tend to overvalue that piece of information. I think that the 99.99% of the knowledge you need to acquire, that is already public. Then you might have some few rare situations where, which is illegal, by the way, you have people having insider knowledge about what a company will do, which will completely drag down the stock. And like tomorrow, if something terrible should happen, then they have an announcement about that. But basically, you know, I don't put too much emphasis on that. I think that the minute you think you need to have inside information and more knowledge than is publicly available, I think that you will probably read the information that is publicly available the wrong way.
You know, Toby Carlyle had a point about this in his book where he talks about this double counting and how the market often moves in dramatic waves where one little piece of information comes out, and if it should have moved the stock up 1%, it moves it up 2 or 3% because everyone overreacted and they're polarized by the information. And so I totally agree with that. And I think that if you look at Warren Buffett's portfolio and whenever he made the large gains that he made, he never did it in a 1 month time frame. He never did it in a 2 month time frame. He did it over years of ownership because he saw something that was special in a company. He saw that the price was undervalued in general terms, and he saw that the company had a competitive advantage that he knew was going to take them into a 10 or 20 year period that was going to outperform other businesses. So when you look at Coke, when he made a large purchase of Coke back in the late 1980s, that was a decision because he felt like people were going to continue to drink soda into the future, that Coke had a brand that was a huge competitive advantage over any other person out there in that space. And it was at a great price whenever he bought it. That was the reason why he has been extremely successful as an investor, because he continued to hold that great stock for that long period of time after he got it for a great price. That's why he was beating the market. And I don't think that that had anything to do with insider information or having a little known fact 10 minutes before the other person.
Yeah. So Stash, you know, as a private investor, I can see why you would often think that, say that, you know, Coca-Cola increased by 5% tomorrow, that you were thinking, wow, it would really be great if I bought in today and then sold tomorrow. But these investors, and especially Warren Buffett, they have so much money and they really move their market. So as Preston is saying, you know, he's really in for the long run. He can't place a bet on Coca-Cola increasing tomorrow, even if he knew that, because it really wouldn't make any difference with the kind of money he have. So basically, I would say, you know, in theory, yes, of course, it's nice to have insider knowledge. But in practice, I don't think it's that important, to say not important at all.
I think that that's a great question, because I think a lot of people have that same opinion and they see it like, oh, well, there's no way I can win because, you know, I don't have the same access to information that other people have. And I think that access to information is very important. Don't get me wrong. But I think at the end of the day, it really comes down to those fundamental elements when you're buying, you know, equity in a business is, do they have a competitive advantage? Do they have a good, stable income statement balance sheet? Is the company undervalued? Is it at a good price relative to all the other options that are available on the market? Those are the key factors that I think people need to pay close attention to. All right, Stas, so we'll send you a free signed copy of the Warren Buffett Accounting Book. And for anybody out there, if you go to asktheinvestors.com and record your question, we will go ahead and send you a free signed copy of the book if it gets played on the air. So, Stas, thank you so much for sending that in. We really appreciate everybody in our audience for joining us each week. And if you're enjoying the show, make sure you go to iTunes and leave us a review, because that really helps our show out and it helps us capture a larger audience. And we just really appreciate everything that everyone in our audience is doing for us. So with that said, we'll see you guys next week. And thanks for joining us.
Thanks for listening to The Investors Podcast. To listen to more shows or access to the tools discussed on the show, be sure to visit www.theinvestorspodcast.com. Submit your questions or request a guest appearance to The Investors Podcast by going to www.asktheinvestors.com. If your question is answered during the show, you will receive a free autographed copy of the Warren Buffett Accounting Book. This podcast is for entertainment purposes only. This material is copyrighted by the TIP Network and must have written approval before commercial application. TIP.